Our next presenter is going to be David G.S. Wood. He's president and the chief design engineer of Ensemble Designs Incorporated. He's proud to say that he once called Madison home, both as a student at the University of Wisconsin, where he graduated with highest honors in electrical and computer engineering, and as chief engineer and director of engineering at WKOW. Before founding Ensemble Designs, David worked as a senior design engineer at Grass Valley Group, where he served as project manager for the Model 100 and 200 production switchers. I'm familiar with both of those. We currently use them in our operations at UW Oshkosh. David likes California, but he says he misses the cheese curds. And I first met David some years ago when the company was just getting off the ground, the first time they exhibited at NAB, and they've really been growing by leaps and bounds. So, David?
Good morning. So it really is a pleasure to be back in Wisconsin. And my wife and I, we got here last night, and in the rain, we were driving around trying to figure out where things were, and we got completely lost. So we'll try it again when the sun is shining. But it's really a pleasure to be back here. And I hope that I can contribute something to the discussion today. I have a general topic to talk about, which is working with and using MPEG transport streams. And I, in a setting like this where we're not a huge group of people, I'm really interested in questions. So as I go along, we don't have to save the questions to the end. If you have a question partway through, raise your hand, because I want to be sure that I'm really taking the discussion in a direction that is helpful to all of us individually and collectively. We're at a point where the technology is changing tremendously in this industry. I thought the previous presentation was very interesting, looking at the effect of antenna polarization on something that, as broadcasters, we were never trying to transmit to that in the past. And so, that's just one example of how this technology is shifting and changing. And it feels as if the rate of change itself is increasing all the time as well. People that don't work in broadcasting, I try to explain what I do, and they think that a broadcast facility, a television station, a network control center, that those are kind of cookie cutter and they're all the same. But we know that they're not, that each one is unique. And my experience is that no one is ever finished building their television station, that it's changing all the time. So not only are the needs changing, and the purposes that people are putting their facility to, but the technology is changing as well. There's a great book written back in the 70s called Future Shock, and I love the quote in that, where the idea here is that future shock was when there was too much change taking place in too short a period of time. And I'm not trying to speak for everyone here, but I know for myself, there are mornings that I feel that way. but at the same time, I think this is still a very exciting business to be in. And as we see all of the changes in technology and how those manifest and how we use them, it makes it both just from a technical standpoint, a fascinating field to still be working in, and as the purposes and the applications expand, it's an expanding field at the same time. So, because it's so complicated, I'm going to limit my remarks to one piece of the system, and just to give like the world's simplest overall block diagram. I will describe real video here as baseband video. So digital or analog, but uncompressed with zero latency. So we'll define that as real video. And the process of encoding to a compressed form, and in general that's going to be MPEG, and eventually decoding back to real video, those that encode and decode, those processes are taking place at different places in the system. They may be completely within a facility. If you think about what happens, say, in a server that's recording high definition, it is doing the encode and decode on the box itself, assuming its inputs and outputs are HDSDI. And in the case of transmission, the encode is at the broadcast plant, and the decode is all the way at the viewer's position, either in a, that was a very attractive stroller too. I'm surprised that the police didn't wonder what kind of nefarious activity they were up to. But it's the piece in between that I want to take a look at. And I want to look at it from the standpoint of what are some of the constituent parts, and what are some of the challenges that it presents when we're working with it in a facility, and what are some of the techniques that we can use to address those challenges. In talking about this, I want to talk about it from a technical standpoint. So I really mean these to be engineering remarks. Having made the shift from being a user of equipment to a designer of equipment, what I see are the fascinating challenges that the work that you folks are doing, that presents huge opportunities for people working on the design side. And the dialogue between these two sides is really important. So I hope that some of my remarks can contribute to that dialogue. But I don't mean it to be a sales pitch. So there are going to be a couple of things I talk about. They're representative of the work that we're doing from a technology, an exploration of technology, and from the standpoint of product development. But we're as much interested in feedback on those ideas as we can be. So at the transport stream, we fundamentally have two techniques that are being used to carry this data from point A to point B, where point A is an encoder and point B is a decoder. And that path can be quite complex, and we'll take a look at what a few of those paths might be. But just to sort of be clear on some of the fundamental pieces, the DVB ASI standard is one that's used worldwide, and the SMPTE 310 standard is essentially unique to North America. So I want to make this interactive just to help me sort of understand where people are at. How many people here are familiar with what DVB ASI is and are using it in their facility? Show of hands. Okay. And how many people think they have SMPTE 310 running in their facility? Okay. So I'm a little surprised because I thought SMPTE 310 edged out DVB ASI. And I said earlier that the path could be is more complex. And this would sort of be an example of a more complex path as things stretch out. And where I mark here, I talk about a complex delivery system. That last little yellow arrow, you know, that's maybe microwave, transmitter, antennas, the home receiver, all of those pieces, they're all part of the transport mechanism that these transport streams are passing through. And I'm not sure if my iconography is very clear, but between the two microwaves, that's supposed to look like a pair of rubber bands. And that's one of the real challenges that we have in these systems, is how many places there are rubber bands and what that does to the quality of the signal. And that's a particular concern if the destination is a transmitter. And in the case of where part of the path might be carried on an IP network, the rubber band gets even bigger and possibly more challenging to work with. Structure of a DVB ASI signal, and if I want to apologize if I'm not hitting the right mark here in terms of people's background and understanding. So I'll try to go through this pretty quickly, but again, hand up, you know, raise your hand if you have a question about it, or just yell at me. The really slick thing about DVB ASI is the clock rate is 270 megabits per second. And that's really handy because it means that we have all of these other pieces of infrastructure in the facility that we're able to carry an SDI signal at 270 megabits. And by and large, those devices, cable, obviously, distribution amplifiers, routing switchers, if they were able to carry SDSDI, they're generally able to carry DVB ASI. But unlike an SDSDI signal, which is essentially a uncompressed live television signal that is simply being transmitted in digital form, much as it would have been in an analog system with vertical intervals and horizontal intervals and the picture scanned out pixel by pixel, and if there were 100 frames in a row that are all identical, no problem, we'll just send 100 identical frames. In the case of DVB ASI, that's not at all what's being transmitted. We'll look at what that is structured like, but basically data is going out as packets. And what I show here in this line at the top are two kinds of packets. The bright green are data packets, and the gray are null packets. And there's padding in between that is sometimes referred to as a comma character. And what that means is that the packet itself, and we'll take a little bit of a look at what that means, that the packet is constructed according to the transport stream specification. And we simply want to take that block of data packet by packet and transmit it, but we're transmitting it on a channel that has a much, much higher data rate. So, for example, a standard definition MPEG-2 stream might have a data rate in the neighborhood of 5 megabits per second. HD might be in the neighborhood of 13 megabits per second, something in that general region. So what happens when we transmit it on a carrier that's running at 270 megabits per second? Well, the packets have a lot of space in between them. And the number of comma characters is the difference between the clock rate, in this case 270 megabits, and the actual bit rate that we're transmitting. So that, if you do the math in your head, you can tell that the drawing that I've made is completely out of proportion, that there's far more time spent between packets than time is spent on packets. So you could think of it that what's happening in DVB ASI is that the data is coming out in packets and they're very short bursts, and there's a big gap in between. Now, I don't have a drawing for the SMPTE 310 case, but the SMPTE 310 case doesn't have any comma characters. And the reason that SMPTE 310 is essentially a North American standard is that it is very tightly constructed around the requirements of ATSC transmission. And there are no comma characters, and the 19.3 megabit data rate that's in a SMPTE 310 signal is exactly what wants to come out eventually, 8 VSB modulation coming out of the broadcast antenna. And that means that the SMPTE 310 standard is very narrowly focused on digital transmission in the ATSC world. Outside of North America, that modulation technique isn't used, and so 310 has no isn't useful outside of North America. And one of the trends that I think we're going to see is a shift in the choices that a lot of manufacturers make about equipment away from 310 and toward DVB ASI. Because the ASI standard is a truly international standard. In fact, the DVB organization is a European-based, that's where their principal offices are, consortium that has defined a lot of these things. And we're going to see, I think, more acceptance of the ASI standard, say, as the inputs to transmitters in microwave systems and that sort of thing. As that happens, though, we have to be really careful as to how the conversions are made, because ultimately for transmission, we're really, really interested in what the, for the over-the-air transmission aspect of the use of the system, it's really important what the clock quality of the signal is. Show of hands, how many people know what a PAT is? Good. So I'll go through this quickly. So in a transport stream, there will be one PAT, program allocation table, that tells downstream devices what programs are present. And it's always at PID, packet ID 0. It's sort of the secret decoder ring that lets you sort through all of the data that's coming through in this stream. Then for every program, there is a PMT, the program map table, and the PID for that is given in the PAT. So the process of working through one of these streams, sort of looking through what's there and decoding it, starts with the PAT through the PMT, and the PMT will be one program. So for example, in the case of an over-the-air broadcaster who's transmitting an HD and an SD signal, there'll be a PMT for the HD and another one for the SD. Then the PMT in turn will reference a video, at the very least, a video stream and an audio stream. And these are referred to as elemental streams. And at this point, we shift into the, generally into the MPEG world to define what the video elemental stream looks like. And depending upon what standard is being used for audio compression, what it looks like. And there will be many, many, many packets of the video and audio, because that's the real meat and potatoes of what's being transmitted. And this structure lets us, you know, this is what lets us transmit a very large number of programs on a single broadcast channel. I'm going to tell you a little bit about a broadcaster that we have done some experimental work with, who's based in LA, and it's an independent channel in Los Angeles. And one of their services, they have sold bandwidth in their general transmission, and they carry between 12 and 13 standard definition signals on a single 19.3 megabit transmission path. And it's hard for me to believe that that actually works, but they're quite successful at it. And so their program allocation table and PMT mapping is very complex in a system like that. Now, ultimately, for transmission, we need a fixed stream rate. And so the actual content, the video content and the audio content, it's going to be varying in its data demands. And so that's what the red line shows, is the varying data content. And you'll notice that I have cleverly kept this below the green line. If we went over the green line, we'd be in a big heap of trouble. I guess that would be the digital equivalent of sync buzz if we simply ran out of bit bandwidth. So the transmitter wants a constant data rate, and that gets delivered with null packets, and the null packets make up the difference between the useful payload and the fixed stream rate. So the null packets, the quantity of them is varying inversely to the variation in the program rate to keep the channel packed constantly. I wanted to throw this idea in. Now, I don't mean to sound like a whiner, but it's really hard for me to understand sometimes that in the digital age, we still have interlaced formats. I wasn't quite sure where this slide should go in this presentation, but it's the idea that we're constantly evolving, and there haven't really been many revolutions in television. Some might look at it and say, what was a revolution to start transmitting in high definition? But I think for most broadcasters, it was a little, you know, you add a piece here, you add a piece there, this changes, that changes, and over a period of time, there you are. And so there are some things that get carried along and other things that don't get carried along. It's kind of interesting, you know, what some of those are. I have a younger guy on my staff who doesn't quite have the, the old fart view of television, and he at least once a week has to yell about interlace because he feels like he trips over it all the time. And so that comment isn't necessarily specific to this discussion, but just in general, I think it's sort of a reflection of what we face as we ourselves process through these revolutions. So there's three challenges with transport streams that I want to speak to. One is clock quality. The second is data integrity and the cliff effect. And again, the previous discussion on antenna polarization did a really good job of presenting the idea of bit error rate and a question. Steve, you raised the question about, you know, what's the impact of that on picture quality, and I'll speak to that a little bit. And then I want to talk a little bit about switching within transport streams and latency issues. So I'm going to start by talking about clock defects. Now, a lot of the issue about defects in the clocks that are being used to carry the signal through, are of particular importance for transmission. And one of the challenges we have is that a lot of the standards that we're working with were never intended to be used for transmission, for over-the-air broadcast. And so they have some inherent, there's some pitfalls sort of built in because those weren't considered in the first place. One of the transmitter designers that I've done some work with in looking at over-the-air transmission and clock quality suggested the idea for the clockometer. And his general comment is that what comes out of an MPEG encoder, which was designed by computer people, is a clock that is basically a computer-grade clock. And computer-grade clocks are just fine, thank you, for use in a computer, but they're not on frequency the way we think of being on frequency. They are, they have jitter, they're drifting around. As he put it, they're just one notch above a sundial. And he would refer to a radio clock, meaning a clock whose frequency, accuracy, jitter, phase drift, all of those things was sufficient for radio broadcast, and in particular for digital transmission. So one of the things that we've been looking at, and one of the areas that I think is easy to sort of overlook, is what the quality of that clock winds up being. Now, these are not real eye patterns. These are sort of an artist's conception of an eye pattern. And in the upper left is a roughly what you're accustomed to seeing if you look on a digital waveform monitor, the eye pattern for an SD or an HD SDI signal. So we'll imagine now that that's a 270 megabit signal. That's a DVB ASI transport stream. The more complex drawing is sort of a conceptual idea of the 8 VSB modulation that's used for transmission. And the challenge here in many transmission systems is that the modulation clocks get derived from the transport clocks. And if the path from origin to the transmitter site has compromised the accuracy and introduced noise and jitter to the transport clock, then it is going to impinge on the broadcast clock, on the radio clock, as my friend David Hirschberger would say. And that is going to compromise transmission integrity. The whole idea of bit error rate and what we're delivering at the very end speaks to that. The cleaner the signal when it leaves the antenna, the better it's going to be down the road, regardless of choice of antenna, and choice of receiver. So one of the ideas that we have been examining is what can we do to improve the quality of the clock? And what that really winds up needing to be is sort of a time-based corrector that can be applied to a transport stream to take the content, the data payload, off of the clock that it's traveling on and place it on a new clock that's derived from a better source than the inherent bit clock in, say, a DVB ASI stream. And the way that we've been doing that is to take incoming data, and again, here we have data packets and null packets. Now, a null packet is exactly the same size as a data packet. It just doesn't have any useful content. It has an extremely useful purpose, though, and that is to provide constant size packing of the channel. So if we take the incoming data and we just discard all of the null packets and load that into a data buffer, we basically have kept all of the useful content. And a data buffer really just becomes a piece of memory. Then on the playout side, that same data buffer is driven by a reference clock. And that's where we gain the opportunity to rebuild the clock. As we'll see, I'm going to speak briefly about single frequency networks and some mobile and handheld considerations. And in those systems, using clocks at opposite, at the far ends of a system, that are both tied, locked to a common reference, allows all of the rubber banding in the middle of the path to be eliminated. It just disappears. Because at the origin point, data gets loaded into the channel based on the same clock that is at the destination that's going to pull it out. And then what happens in between disappears. Now, when that idea was first proposed to me for sort of ordinary studio Genlock, and I said, well, how long a piece of black burst cable are you planning to run, you know, across town? And one of the amazing things, at least to me, one of the amazing things about GPS technology is that using a GPS-based clock generation system in a master sync pulse generator provides a benefit even greater than using a rack-mounted atomic standard. 30, 40 years ago, that was the way to go, was you'd buy a rack-mounted rubidium or cesium standard that made perfect 10 megahertz, and you locked everything to that. But if you had two such standards, they still weren't exactly the same. A GPS-based system where the 10 megahertz is derived from the signal received by a GPS receiver from this galaxy of satellites that's circling the Earth, the amazing thing, amazing to me at least, about that is that at two locations with two receivers, the two clocks are the same. They are the same frequency, and their drift, one with respect to the other, is down on the order of less than a cycle across days and days and days, if not weeks and months. And so it does give us the ability to basically pull out of the sky a reference point at the origin and one at the destination that we can, from a mathematical standpoint, we can view those as being the same. And so that's what we would do here in the outgoing data, is that the reference would be derived from a standard that good. And we take the data packets and we know what the data rate should be, and we drop null packets in order to bring things back up to that desired data rate. And at this point, we have disconnected, the output of this system is disconnected from the input in terms of both the underlying, the clock accuracy, as well as phase shift and drift and jitter that would be present. These are plots generated by a Tektronix MPEG analyzer. And how many people are familiar with looking at these? I apologize that the pictures are so small. I'll explain what each one is. The upper right is a plot of PCR inaccuracy. So PCR is the program clock reference. It's a packet that comes along several times per second in the stream. And it's basically, imagine you had a counter that was counting cycles of a 27 megahertz clock. And once or twice a second, you just mailed everybody what that count was. And that's the underlying timing mechanism that's used in MPEG in order to coordinate at the decoder the reconstruction of the signal. So the blue line through the center is the measurement of PCR inaccuracy, and the red band above and below represents the sort of standard, legal, acceptable deviation. And this is a plot of the analyzer after it's passed through this time-based correction type of function. So you can see that there is essentially no inaccuracy in the PCR. And the left plot is PCR overall jitter, And that speaks to instantaneous and temporal impact that could be in the signal. And then finally, the lower right-hand corner is the variation between the PCR, this is basically the metronome that's carried in the signal, and the PTS. This MPEG world is packed with three-letter acronyms. I feel like I need a little decoder book to thumb through all the time. So PTS is the presentation timestamp, and that indicates, relative to this drumbeat clock, when a particular frame of video is supposed to play back. And it is always the case that there's going to be some variation because there is finite granularity in where these packets can be placed in the system. But again, this demonstrates how all of that is kept well within that path, or well within the bounds that are considered acceptable and decodable. I wish I had a slide of what it looks like after it's come through an IP link, because IP links just cause total havoc with these measurements because they are themselves packetized systems. So you start with packetized data, you packetize it further, and shove it into a system that has highly variable latency, and it's just all over the map. And a way to clean that up is really essential. This is not a video game. I made this drawing to sort of illustrate the idea of a single frequency network, which when I first learned about these, I thought it was the weirdest thing I'd ever heard of, because I thought we always tried to avoid multipath. And here we have a system where we want it. So just as a quick sort of conceptual idea, the three blue target emitters represent transmitters. And they form a single frequency network because they're all transmitting the same signal at the same frequency at the same time. And the yellow bars represent obstacles. They could be buildings, it could be terrain, what have you. And the receivers are the four purple triangles. And you'll see that there are some receivers that, due to the obstacles, only receive the signal from one transmitter. I have one in the middle that can get it from two, but not all three. And then the one at the bottom actually gets it from all three. And I am not aware of there being any single frequency networks in Wisconsin. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong about that. They're not that common in the United States because the power levels that we can deliver ATSC at are relatively speaking so high that they're not very often needed. Europe, because they don't use Europe has a much higher population density, and they use smaller transmitter sites at lower power, and so they do use SFN a lot more. However, as some of the delivery mechanisms shift toward mobile and handheld, for mobile and handheld, a single frequency network is sort of the normal case. Yes?
I think Qualcomm's media flow, which was on Channel 55, in several cities.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So again, that's their the media flow that's on, is it through Verizon that you see that, or? Yes. They paid for all the equipment they bought from us before that happened, though, so we're okay. And I think that, you know, the shift toward more and more mobile devices, we're gonna see more of these systems. In order for this to work, all three of those transmitters have to be transmitting exactly the same thing. And so there are some particular standards that are used at the exciter and in the modulator, but in the transport paths to deliver the signals there as well. And each one of those transmitter sites requires a GPS-locked frequency source in order to get everybody on frequency. Data integrity, so that's my next topic. And here we're dealing with how we not only protect, but how we identify cases where we've failed to deliver good data integrity, low bit error rates. And we're faced with complex content and the data that's in it, and the presence of proprietary data, that there are all sorts of private packets that are carried in a lot of these systems for telemetry, perhaps, for signaling. A lot of ASI streams, when they're not necessarily being used in over-the-air broadcast, but in direct satellite systems, they take advantage of the packet structure and the fact that all these packets can be, they're basically addressable, to use that mechanism to carry subscriber data and enables and that kind of thing. And then we also have the fact that the data is going through a very complex path. I discussed earlier about IP systems, and with microwave paths, there are cases where the forward error correction, as much as it provides a very useful benefit, it also tends to mask problems. And so until when you run out of forward error correction capability, then the problems appear. So if we go back to this sort of simplified block diagram, one of the ideas that we've been looking at is if we just look at this system from a transport path standpoint, we really aren't interested in how an MPEG encoder works, and we don't have to worry about how an MPEG decoder works. Our job is just to get the data from point A to point B, ideally with perfect integrity. And so the question then is, how do we test it when we get to that endpoint in the process? And the idea that we've been exploring is, because there are null packets in the stream, and there are always at least a few null packets. Now, if you look at a MPEG stream analyzer, one of the statistics that is generally provided is what the null rate is, or the null packet rate. And it's usually expressed in kilobits or megabits per second. And since a packet is, each packet is just shy of 2 kilobits, so even with a 100 kilobit per second null rate, there are still multiple packets per second that could be borrowed. So what we've been working with is, we've been testing a system where we remove about 10 null packets in every 1 second of transmission. And we replace it with a checksum, or a CRC, a cyclic redundancy check packet, where we have calculated the CRC across all of the data packets, either between two PCRs or between the CRC packets that we're inserting. So we do that at the transmission end, at the outset. Then at the receiving end, or at some downstream monitoring position, we can, we pull out that CRC packet and we test it against the data, and we can give an error seconds count as well as a data integrity test. So, and we can then replace it with a null packet, so at the end of the transmission scheme, it looks exactly as it had in the first place. So if we do that, now within this circle that we're trying to protect from a data integrity standpoint, as the data enters, crosses into the circle, we insert a checksum, about 10 of them per second. And as it leaves the circle, we test that checksum, and we can give status on data integrity. And the same broadcaster that I mentioned in Los Angeles, we've done some very interesting testing with them, where we put this system at the origin at the studio. So the output of the MPEG encoder downstream of master control, we put the checksum inserter. And then his path, if you will, everything that's within the circle, consisted of a digital radio, a digital microwave to a transmitter, to a relay tower, another microwave to the actual transmitter up on Mount Wilson in Los Angeles, over the air transmission, and he made the choice. He just let the packet continue. So he let the checksum packet even pass through the modulator over the air. Then back at the studio, he has a off-air receiver that demodulates the ATSC signal and gives him back a DVB ASI output. And we put that into the checksum test. And neither one of us really knew what we were going to get at that point, because we never had had a mechanism to look at that entire path in one go. It's unfortunate that that didn't get built into the DVB ASI standard. There's no mechanism in MPEG to measure data integrity. So, the question earlier was, what does that do to the picture? I understand why the previous tests were done with just data patterns, because those can be measured. And for transmission purposes, being able to measure and quantify error rates, I think, is very, very interesting and very useful. So what we discovered was this guy had built a perfect transmission system. He went days without a single error through that entire path. And he thought his system was pretty good. He didn't realize how good it was. And what was very interesting was that included the entire over-the-air portion of the system as well. Now, we have done some tests to speak to Steve's question about what does an error rate mean with regard to picture impairment. And that's a very, very difficult question to answer explicitly, because it all depends which packet took an error. And some packets are redundant. The program allocation table packet is basically once or twice a second comes a PAT packet, and they're all the same for hours or days at a time. And so if an error lands on one of those, it doesn't matter. And the error can land in different places in different packets and have a different effect. So in order to sort of look at this, we constructed an error generator where we took a transport stream, and the error that we generated was we would dial in to a particular position in a packet, and if the bit was a 1, we made it a 0. If it was a 0, we made it a 1. We made the smallest error we possibly could. And we did it in several different ways so that we could address different parts of the system. So in this case, we are sort of paying attention, if you will, to how an MPEG encoder works, because we recognize that errors in some parts of the stream are going to be more damaging than others. And what we found is that an error rate down in the 0.02 parts per million, so that's 2 in 10 to the minus 8th. That is just barely visible in MPEG-2 compression of SD or HDSDI. And it doesn't really matter a lot whether it's SDSDI or HDSDI. But it's just barely visible. It also, whether it's visible or not, depends on the decoder. And we found, as we would expect, decoders, they're imperfect. You know, there's sort of a laboratory standard of what a decoder should do, and some come closer to that standard than others. And part of the testing we did, we bought a series of consumer displays because we wanted to see what the end-to-end path looked like. So we bought several consumer displays and we built our own television station. We used a 1RU 8VSB modulator. And so we would take this DVB ASI signal that we had put errors in, modulate it, and then deliver it as if it were over the air into these receivers. And we found that there was a tremendous variation where with a very low error rate, some receivers, essentially, you couldn't see it. And on others, the picture would completely block for an instant and reset. So it comes back to the question, it almost can't be answered because it isn't a question of what it does to the picture, it's what does it do to the decoder, and there are so many different decoders. Switching. So and I'm down to zero time. Do I need to stop or can I finish? Okay. So I just want to make the comment, the trend that I see when I go and visit broadcast plants is in the past, there would have been lots and lots of pieces of coax that were all carrying analog NTSC. It went everywhere. And today, some of those pieces of coax are carrying transport streams. And the number of those is increasing all the time. And so the number of places in a plant where people want to switch signals is increasing all the time as well. And this is one place where the transition to digital has perhaps not served our plant needs as well as we would like. And there may be those among us, myself included, who remember fondly how easy it was to zero time a bunch of sources, analog NTSC sources, into an analog router and switch between them, and you could just put that live on air. And you just can't do that. That was easy in analog. It's hard in SDSDI and HDSDI, and in a transport stream, it's anywhere from very difficult to impossible. So, I have two pictures here. So the idea here is some ideas that we've been looking at some ideas we've been looking at about where or how we could switch in a transport stream. And if I zoom in a little bit, this is representative. This is sort of a conceptual representation of an MPEG-2 transport stream. And each of the little arrows, and I'm not sure, it's not very bright. There are little tiny arrows pointing up at these boxes, and those arrows are sort of identifying potential switch points. You know, if you switch between signal A and signal B in SDI or in analog NTSC, you can switch in the vertical interval between any frame and any other frame because downstream, you don't need any history of what came before. You get a whole new shot at it every time a frame comes by. Well, here in MPEG, that's not the case. So the iframe that's sort of in the middle here, an iframe is a, I always mix up inter and intra, intra-coded frame. An iframe completely defines one frame of the original content and doesn't require any information about any other frame. It's basically, simplistically, a JPEG of one frame of the picture. Now, if we were to do that for every single frame, the size of the MPEG, the MPEG stream would be such a high bit rate we couldn't transmit it over the air. So subsequent frames are P frames and B frames, and those are frames that are based upon content that came before it or will come later. So the little curvy lines and arrows sort of indicate, if they're pointing into a frame, it says this frame is requiring content from these other frames in order to decode it. So that becomes a challenge because we can't switch between those two frames, at least not if we think we're going to switch cleanly, the way we're accustomed to in an uncompressed environment. And yet, as more and more of the signals in a plant become compressed, the need to do that in the compressed world shows up more and more. Just the simple case of the studio to transmitter link in a digital plant, it could be one part fiber, one part microwave, two parts fiber, what have you. If there's meant to be a redundancy switch to automatically switch on a failover at the transmitter site, well, there might be times you want to throw that switch manually in order to do maintenance on an alternate path. And if that manual switch causes a glitch, then that's a challenge. And depending upon how these multiple streams have been generated, if they were identically encoded, it's simpler. The worst case at the bottom is two streams that are completely different, that have no commonality whatsoever. And it's essentially impossible to switch cleanly between those two streams because you can't ever align the iframes in a way that will make any sense. It would require a full decode and re-encode, and that's very time-consuming. It's on the order of seconds to do that. So what we're looking at is, this is the big block diagram, and this is the zoom-in, is to have a packet alignment and timing offset that's tracking and looking for those switch point opportunities so that we have then what we would refer to as a packet aligned switch that can look at a way to switch cleanly between those. And downstream of that, we have to then reformat the program clock reference, the presentation timestamp, and the display timestamp in order for those to be consistent at the output. I'm going to close, and then I'll see if there are questions and if I have any time left. But for you Wisconsin broadcasters with a memory from the Where Are They Now department, I just wanted to give a shout out to Bob Zilsdorf, who celebrated his 80th birthday about a month ago, August 23rd. My birthday is the 25th, and he always beats me to that. And so he's in California, lives in Grass Valley, California. And so this is from his birthday a month ago, and his family, Kay, and daughters, Kathleen and Cindy, were all there too. So I just wanted to share that. And he wishes he could be here too, as an old Wisconsin broadcaster. And so that's what I have to present. Are there questions? John, here, we're going to amplify you.
Okay, you mentioned DVB-ASI being the same as SDI, 270 meg.
From a
clock.
Data rate standpoint.
Yes.
Yes.
It is interesting. You can pass ASI through an SDI stream sometimes, like DA. I have no idea why, reason, some manufacturers like to invert the outputs of some of the outputs.
Right.
ASI will not go through an inverted stream.
Correct.
Where SDI will.
Yes.
So we have certainly found times when we need to DA these, and we have to use two DAs sometimes to invert it and then invert it back again so that it'll work.
Right. So that's happening because it's the common design for a SDI coaxial driver is a amplifier with differential outputs, and because it draws constant power. And both of those outputs are valid to drive a BNC. So it's typical on a distribution amplifier that half of the outputs will be phase up and half are phase down. And for the SDI world, it doesn't matter. But you're correct that the data encoding in ASI is a 8B, 10B encoding, and it doesn't like being inverted. However, there are more and more DVB ASI products these days whose input circuits are recognizing it's inverted and are fixing it for you. So to some degree, that problem may go away. But John's point is a really good one, is to pay attention. If you've got a DA, you cannot assume that all outputs are going to work for ASI. Any other questions? Thank you for your kind attention, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day here.